Hello and welcome to another edition of Heart of Healthcare. My name is Dr. Jan Bonhoeffer, and these podcasts are about helping physicians restore balance in their lives so we can create a medical system that benefits everyone. A quick reminder that you can find more information about our nonprofit Heart-Based Medicine and the work we do to support healthcare professionals at heartbasedmedicine.org.
Welcome to the Heart of Healthcare podcast, Series 2, Episode 10, when we're asking, can we ease the epidemic of anxiety that has taken over the health system?
And today, we're lucky enough to be joined by Alison Escalante. Dr. Alison is a pediatrician, a TEDx speaker, a writer, and woman on a mission to ease the epidemic of anxiety that has convinced us we are always failing and is stealing our joy. She has developed a three-step method to help parents raise their kids skillfully and enjoy doing it. She writes for Forbes on the science of human performance and Psychology Today on life in the culture of anxiety. Alison has degrees from Princeton, Rutgers, and has been trained at Duke and the University of Chicago. Alison is also an adjunct faculty member of Rush University School of Medicine. Welcome, Alison.
Thank you so much.
And I'm also delighted to welcome back my regular fellow podcast panelist all the way from Hawaii, Dr. Dan Dinnenberg. Dr. Dan was one of the original physicians at One Medical, and as a clinical instructor at UCSF, has had extensive training in functional medicine with double board certifications in family medicine and integrative holistic medicine. Hello and welcome, Dan.
Hi, Jan. It's a pleasure to be here. Hi, Alison.
Hi.
So let's dive into this. At Heart-Based Medicine, we are looking to create a conversation around how the medical profession could transform to embrace a more heart-centered approach. And Alison, we wonder if you could tell us when and how you came to embrace a heart-centered approach to medicine.
I think it was what I always wanted. I think it was what I was looking for when I sought to become a doctor in the first place. But medical training is very intense, very rushed. And there, you know, it's not, we were taught about subjects like how it's good to have empathy for your patients. But I generally left my medical training with the impression that I was not wanted. What was wanted was my brain. What was wanted was my skill set. And that I was fundamentally replaceable, really, you know, as long as I... So there was this urge to become the most skillful and knowledgeable doctor. And I took that into my first couple of years in practice, but quickly learned that something was missing. And as I grew as a doctor, and as I became a mother, because remember, I'm a pediatrician, so I'm working with families, it naturally evolved that I was sharing in that experience with the parents. I was also beginning to coach and of course, caring for their children. Medicine without the heart is empty.
Hmm. Wow. Very crisp and clear. And I couldn't agree more with you. There's two things I want to share here. One is that for me as a pediatrician, because we share the same profession, it was a huge difference being a pediatrician before and after being a father. And from that perspective, luckily, it took quite a while. I was a pediatrician for many years without children. And so I couldn't put it to, I was the unexperienced, and then I was the more of his experience. It's nothing to do with experience. It's actually being the patient. It's actually learning to see the eyes through the world through the patient's eyes. Yes. And that's something I had never experienced to this degree. So to see somebody is in pain and to know that pain is uncomfortable and to be compassionate from this knowing point is very fundamentally different to actually knowing what that person feels because you've been there, done that as a parent, for example.
I relate to that. I think the experience was slightly different for me for two reasons. One, my history training was in ideological and cultural history and what's called cultural interpretation. In other words, the discipline of stripping off all of your modern assumptions as best you can and interacting with the original texts or the historical period as best you can from the eyes of the people of the time. And it was a wonderful discipline. And I think whenever I could throughout my medical training, I did that. It's just that time and the rush gets in the way. I also came into medicine having already experienced a variety of difficult things in my life, and family, you know, tragedies and traumas, things like that. So that I already knew what it felt like to suffer. I already knew what it was, maybe not to be a mother, but to be an older sister and watch a younger brother suffer. And so I think empathy wasn't a challenge for me. It wasn't something I had to learn. My problem was I didn't have anyone to coach me for how to handle all the empathy. And so I actually became overwhelmed and irritable, and reverted to this person that they were training me to be, which is the skillful, knowledgeable doctor. I personally think that everyone trained in any of the healing arts should work with a therapist throughout training. I think that it's a wonderful idea. We don't do it. And I think we ought to. Psychiatrists used to do that as part of their training. It's no longer required for psychiatrists, you know. They don't have to do their own analysis, in fact. But anyway, that's one path. But there are many paths to coming to people in a wholehearted way. And I think that when you get there, it's healing for the physician as well. It's amazing to realize that it's not just my knowledge that I bring to the interaction, that there is a kind of friendship there, that this is, that there's a value to me being in the room. And when you're counseling parents in our culture, especially, it's really in all of the industrialized nations, but it's terrible in the US, where mothers often are left with this sense that who they are is of little value. All that matters is the way that they serve their children. And you're telling them you matter and bring yourself to your child, because we know that that's critical for child development. And you're sitting there believing that yourself is not valuable. All that matters is your service. You see the problem. And when you start to come into the room from yourself, from your heart, and realize that, that's welcome to your patients' families, that they actually want you there, and that it's healing to both of you, it changes everything.
Isn't that amazing that we have been trained that showing up as who we are rather than the role we're given is subjective and creating bias and interfering with objectivity and professional distanced interaction with the patient, while that's actually what the patient is looking for, to be heard and seen and to actually feel being accompanied and guided by a real human being rather than some technical robot who's learned some good things in school.
Well, isn't that the same thing that happens in our own homes? I mean, again, as a father, we're modeling that behavior. I could all day long say what I think my kids should do, but as soon as they see what my wife and I are doing, that is resonating as a huge force, in the same way that when I bring who I am and my heart into my patient interactions, you're modeling behavior and you're allowing them to become more of what Allison said, kind of the value of who they are, more than just in service to their children and the chauffeur that brought the child to you that day. Allison, I love what you're saying with the movement, because I feel the same way. I'm a family physician, and through training, I think that skill and knowledge is what we were trained for. I mean, I think that, you know, Jan and I have multiple times tried to get back into like, well, if you look at sort of the bias of who we're bringing in and how we're bringing someone into the field through our training, that's what we're looking for. It's, you know, people that are excelling in test taking, and then you're actually compromising your own life in some ways to even get into the field. And so what we're opening up to right now, though, in this conversation is how do we marry our own heart, you know, empathy and compassion, and bring in that skill and knowledge and kind of how to bring that together. I have a question for you, Allison. Do you notice now that what you used to feel like you were looked for the skill and knowledge. And now obviously you've developed kind of your empathy. Are you invited to have both? Are you invited one versus the other? Like, where do you feel like you are showing up? Is it all of it together, or is there a part of your patients that are now looking for your vulnerability and your share?
I certainly think it's both. I'm a massive nerd. And so there's really just no way to avoid that. In fact, my patients, people come to me for a variety of reasons. One is the openness and the vulnerability, but the other is the nerd. And they absolutely love the fact that you can't get through much of a visit with me, at least, especially one of our, our checkups where you look at child development and you do preventative care. And I always spend a little time trying to help parents understand, why does your child act this way? How do they think? And how can you foster and support them, right? Parents in the US always ask, what do I need to do to help my child develop? In other words, what optimization product do I need to buy? What tech do I need, technique? And I, of course, use that to talk to them about how the fact is human kids are wired to develop. What they need is loving, genuine interaction with their parents. And so if you drop the worry and you just hang with your kid, it's going to be fine. But I want to go back to, and there's two things you guys brought up that both have to be addressed. One is, well, you do want a smart doctor, right? And you do want someone with all of those skills. And in my experience as a teacher of medical students, all of them seem to have wonderful hearts that are longing to, they are longing to practice heart-based medicine, to call it that. And it just gets squeezed out. I think that, that's who goes into medicine, is in most cases people who want to help. If they were primarily motivated by achieving challenges or financial remuneration, there are plenty of other fields where you can do that with a much shorter pathway, right? So most people who go into medicine really are idealistic do-gooders who want to help. And then you just get squeezed by the training process, by the burnout, the exhaustion, and so forth. But again, I do think that we want skillful physicians. We want people who know their stuff. And we also need to make space for ourselves and our patients. And that always brings me back to time. But the other thing I just had to say before we go into that is what you talked about being a parent, right? And about you might say what you should say to your kids, or you can model for them how to be. Well, that is exactly what my upcoming book will be about. It's about the method I've designed for parents that helps parents step into the moment and be present with their kids in a mindful and heart-based way.
This is particularly, we're really looking forward to this book and we want to know more about it. And just before we go there, this is particularly important at our time right now, a time of anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. Where anxiety is so prevalent. And you have been quite vocal about this prevailing culture of criticism and anxiety in the culture, in the family, but also in medical practice. And you've coined the phrase, the should storm. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
That's right. We live in a storm of shoulds. We should do this. We should do that. We should never do that other thing. We should optimize everything, ourselves, our performance, our children. We should enrich our children until it's coming out of their ears. And if we fail in any way, we will mess our children up for life. If we fail in any way in our careers, we might mess ourselves up for life. This culture is really present in, I originally came upon it when I was trying to understand what was going on with parents and families as a young pediatrician. And my training in cultural analysis really helped here. But as soon as I spoke about the parenting culture at TEDx, people just came from everywhere to say, well, wait a minute, the should storm is there in medicine too. Well, wait a minute, the should storm is present in our educational system, right? The kids are under extreme pressure to perform. Well, wait a minute. It's at every high performance corporation in the US and probably elsewhere, right? And so you can think of it as the sense that nothing's enough. That it's a sense that we should optimize everything. We should perform all the time. We should not need much, right? And we shouldn't really experience much weakness or vulnerability unless it's a very deliberate choice as part of our self-development to optimize ourselves, right? And you recognize it because it's there. And it can look different in different situations. In medicine, it often just, it's a particular culture that leads to what we've already talked about. And in the US is associated with a real pressure to see as many patients as possible in as short a time as possible, which unfortunately is the direct opposite of what is needed to practice true heart-based medicine, because heart-based medicine requires unrushed time to be present to ourselves and our patients. And that is incompatible. So what I do is I try to carve that out as best I can in the structures I'm in. And, because I'm not someone who can create institutional reform, and you can't just do this in one institution, the whole system has to change. I speak specifically to the US, not because I don't think this is a problem elsewhere, but because I simply don't have that firsthand knowledge of what it's like to work in the UK or, wherever. And so that's it, is that what I look at is, well, okay, in these structures where I am, in this situation where I am with these competing needs, what can I do right now as an individual to make this happen as much as possible? And that's why I created the Psy, See, and Start method, both for parents, but I also use it as a physician. And I think it really dovetails nicely to a heart-based approach.
Great. Please expand on this, because this is, please expand a little bit on the Psy, See, and Start. So there is the, what I hear from you is there's a new generation of healthcare professionals, fundamentally heartful, wanting to practice, let's call it heart-based medicine. And then they're facing all the financial pressures and the legal pressures and the current values of how to show up as a physician. And this is kind of gradually but surely driven out of them, right?
Perhaps. I mean, I think that was true of my generation too. I suspect it was true for most physicians all along. I remember reading, before I became a doctor, reading the autobiography of C. Everett Koop, who was the Surgeon General at one point in the US. And like a lot of people, there's controversies about some of the stances he took. But fundamentally, his point was that when he was becoming a doctor, it was typical to choose the person who seemed to be of good character, who seemed to be the good person. And he was bemoaning the fact that education had changed and it was now very much focused on intelligence and test scores. And he thought that was very problematic. So I don't know that medicine's always been this way. I do think that the pace has moved faster and faster, but the fundamental person who chooses it as a general rule, I think, has not changed, which is, I think we all want it,
right,
to be a healer, not just a technician. And I think that that the rush and the bustle is what interferes.
So before we go kind of beyond into the future, let me just ask really to just for you to unpack the Psy, See, and Start. What is it? Can you elaborate on this a little bit more?
In this culture, we are so driven by all these things we feel we should do that we become distracted from the present. In parenting, what we often do is we focus on the should. In our head. So-and-so said, how could you let the baby cry like that? And you're reacting to that instead of the child in front of you. So every time, and those shoulds drive anxiety. The only thing worse than a should in our current culture is being unsure, because you should always know what you ought to do. And so when you're unsure, that's even worse. So then we immediately look for a should to guide us. And this leads people to internet searches or all sorts of things. Facebook mom groups, which are just rife with shoulding all over each other. And we have our own version of this in medicine, of course. And so in order to be with our children, we need to get free of the anxiety and the shoulds. So every time you feel a should, sigh, see, and start. Sigh. Take a deep breath into the body and let it go long and slow. Now, we all know there are many wonderful breathing techniques out there, but sigh is a natural, biological, built-in mechanism we have that brings immediate calming. We sigh, we breathe out very slowly, which sends a message of safety to the vagus nerve and tells our body that we can calm down and come into the present. To put it one way that Stephen Porges would say, who does a lot of research on the vagus nerve, you can't breathe out long and slow when you're being chased by a lion, can you? And so it's a way to tell the body it's okay to calm down. Then see your child, see their body language, see the situation, or see your patient, see the electronic medical records, see what's going on in the room. See is a mindfulness step that allows us to come into the present moment with full awareness, without judgment, right? And remember, that's a tricky word in mindfulness, you guys know. Without judgment doesn't mean that we don't eventually make judgments. It just means that when we interact with reality and the present, we don't try to change it immediately. We actually let it be what it is, and we see it for what it is. So we sigh and connect with ourselves. Sometimes I encourage people as they get a little more into this to use that sigh moment to check their bodies and check how they're doing. Check in with their own emotions. Get out of the shoulds a little bit. Then you see and mindfully come into the present. And then we get to the third step, which is my favorite. We start. And this is where we engage creative problem solving. Instead of worrying about getting it right, we just start things. Maybe you start listening. Maybe you start considering a different option. Maybe you start something. Maybe you start nothing. Maybe you start the wrong thing. If you get it right, that's fabulous. You've learned something. You can put that in your toolkit and refer to it in the future. If you start the wrong thing, well, this is a wonderful learning opportunity, but it may trigger an immediate should. Oh, I should have done it that way. I'm a lousy person. Well, what do we do when we feel a should? We sigh, see, and start again. So it's a completely different model than what our culture teaches us. We're no longer worried about getting it right the first time. We're worried about skills development. We're worried about the relationship. We're worried about the child in front of us. And people tell me that it works remarkably fast, that when they start using it with their children or they start using it in their practice with their patients, their anxiety lessens much more quickly than one would expect. And they start to grow in confidence very quickly. The last thing I have to say it, I know I've gone on a long time, but coming back to Dan's point, it's also about modeling, right? So I don't know. I have never been able to convince my children who seem to come by it naturally that they don't have to get it right the first time. It must be a factor in personality, either that or my husband and I have passed on our issues. But I have no amount of explaining, no amount of telling them has worked, right? But I have been able to model vulnerability, model mistakes, model this method. And it might be getting through a little bit.
It's great to hear the Sai Xian start. It's kind of a convergent evolution. And early in pandemic, everyone was talking about PPEs. And, you know, we've been talking about how to take care of ourselves for a long time. And so I coined this sort of pause, presence, engage, which seems very similar. But it's like, look, we should always be putting on our PPEs. And this is what we need to do. And it's so similar to the Sai Xian start. I do see that as the evolution. If we could take care of ourselves and nourish ourselves and take that pause that you speak of, that sigh. As you did it, I did a big, you know, cleansing breath. And I just kind of all of a sudden, I feel the parasympathetic connection that you're talking about. It's like just all of us have that opportunity to do that in our life and to see things in that way. I love this. It's really, you know, when you say see, what brings up for me is too, it's the compassion, of our where we are in our day. You know, if I'm late for a patient, if I'm thinking about things, if I'm going off, also to see the patient in front of us and all of that and everything that's going on there. And that's the way to start or engage. I really, it's a great system. And where do you see this move in? I think all of us understand this that are working in heart-based medicine understand this. You brought up something very interesting, which was time. So like in my own practice, I have, you know, recreated the way that I engage with patients. So I have an entire heart-based medicine type of practice where I'm engaging and I'm spending, you know, at multiple hours a month with a certain client, and we're working on physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual growth, and we're spending time connecting in the relationship. Incredible. But not everybody that's practicing medicine today has created a system for themselves that they have that much time. I know that there is an efficiency model with something like Sai Xian Start because you can do it quickly and you can do it with that. Now, where do you see that moving into the future of medicine, because we are in a sort of what feels like a lot of times a time crunch and certain number of patients that you have to see. And how does this evolve our field? Because what Jan and I are consistently, you know, finding people like yourself that are pushing forward medicine, that are bringing more heart and care into our field in order to actually transform the field. Not just talk about it, but how do we actually implement that? Now, I could see if everybody was Sai Xian starting, there would be a difference. But can you elaborate a little bit on how that moves us into and what you see, especially with your cultural background? How do you see that shift and where are we in that process?
Wow. Well, that was a lot, Dan. First off, you're right. Every fundamental action-based mindfulness method is going to be pretty similar, right? So you're right. Your pause,
presence,
engage is a similar rubric. And so I think we all keep coming to something together. I think what's a little unique about START is introducing this idea of we make mistakes on purpose to learn, and really negating the perfectionism in that way by actionably beating our own perfectionism, right? By becoming little scientists. The other thing I wanted to say about C, because you mentioned compassion, I think that's critical. But I think a fundamental part of compassion that we don't always put together with it is curiosity. So what I love about C is it's a moment to become curious about the person in front of you. And who doesn't want someone to be interested in them? Number three, to go to your how do we actually move medicine forward? Well, I think I would go with my sociologist colleagues there, which is I'm not a sociologist, but my sociologist colleagues constantly remind me that structures really define how we are. Corporate structures, societal structures, time-based structures, economic structures. And so I think that what we can do is limited without structural change. Not every doctor can leave corporate medicine because then so many of our patients don't have the means to be seen in a different model, right? They're dependent on their employer-based insurance policies, right? And so the majority of people are still kind of locked into a certain model, right? So, again, SciSee and START is not meant to be the thing that changes medicine. It's part of a theme in my life, which has been, how do I take effective action under pressure, right? This is the situation I'm in. These are the pressures I've under. I likely developed this philosophy young, having gone through some difficult things as a child, right? Is how do I manage in this situation that I can't change? I can't change the fact that my little brother was hit by a car and has a traumatic brain injury and, you know, and this and that. And I can't change the fact that my mother was hit by a car and had a traumatic brain injury and that the whole house is disrupted. But how can I manage in this situation under these pressures? And so that's what SciSee and START is. And what it does do is, even in a 10 or 15 minute visit, it allows me to step into meaningful curiosity, meaningful presence. And if I'm really spiritually good that day, that sense of timelessness.
Mm.
Now that's a problem, because then I get behind if I get too timeless. and then my other patients get mad because they've been waiting so long. But, do I long for more time? Of course I do. Do I find a way? I believe my patients generally feel they get what they need from me in the time we have. I think so.
Allison, this is so important that we have a way, that we have very simple methods that help us now, tomorrow morning, 8 a.m. when we go back, or 6 a.m. when we go back into the shop, right? So... At the times that healthcare professionals are going through right now, to have ways, simple ways that help us stay there and not leave the profession, help us stay in the team, help continue, is incredibly valuable. We all see that there is somehow a fundamental break in the system. There is a fundamental flaw in the system that is connected with not enoughness. You know, there are investors in a private healthcare system, governments in a governmental healthcare system. There's an interest, right? There's an investor. They're looking for return of investment. They're squeezing management. Management is trying to push the bottom line. Management is squeezing the healthcare professionals so that the return of investment is optimized, and that ends up on the patient's shoulder, who is actually paying for most of it. So there is something that doesn't work, and it seems, you know, time is money. So it seems like taking time is expensive, and that means it's basically available for those who can afford it in many of our current healthcare systems. which is very questionable as a model, particularly in healthcare. So we haven't really pushed through this. So this is something that I guess many of us, whether leaving in droves right now, leaving in cohorts, our profession, or actually staying in there, that's a question we'll have to pursue and see what might be models that allow us to provide equitable healthcare in a system, as you say, in a structure that is not as, I would say, as abusive as the current one is right now. So if we could, I'd love to open that conversation and see, like, what, you know, where are the pioneers in this direction? For today, I wanted to come back to your book, because you've briefly announced your book that you're working on, and you made me curious enough to ask, are you willing to share a couple of words on your new book that you're working on?
Oh, thank you. Yes. Yeah, the book is A SciSee START. Still working on the subtitle, but you know, it's about emerging from the culture of perfectionistic and anxious parenting to raise our children mindfully. And it should be out. The publisher says it'll be out in 2023, most likely. I'm very excited about it. I've been working on the ideas for many years. And it's I always wanted to grow up to be a doctor. I wanted to grow up to be a writer. It was a big surprise when I ended up a doctor. So it's really a delight to be writing as well.
Well, fantastic. Fantastic. And while we need to wait for your book for a little bit still, when people want to look for you, where could they find you and possibly get some sneak peeks of what you will be talking about?
So I have so many completely free resources for parents or for professionals on my website. It also connects to all my social media. I'm on all of them, including recently TikTok. So you can just go to my name, AllisonEscalante.com, or even more easily, SciCStart.com.
Whoa, excellent. Well, great. Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for being on the show. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Heart of Healthcare Podcast Series 2. And you can find more information at heartbasedmedicine.org. And I deeply appreciate if you could click subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on. So until next time. Take good care of yourself.
This has been a Heart-Based Medicine production. Thanks for listening.